when I was asked to address a conference on the theme of does politics need God, I knew the answer right away. Yes. Yes, the answer is yes. Now, if you know anything about my background, and Father alluded to it, you might think that that's startling, even terrifying, that an Iranian would say that politics is a godly realm and that God belongs in politics properly understood. So I'll tell you, if you don't know about that background, I'll tell you a little bit about it. I was born in Tehran, Iran, 6 years to the day that the Ayatollah Khomeini returned from his Parisian exile to topple the former regime of the Shah and herald the new Islamic Republic of Iran. So I'm a child, in other words, of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. Under Khomeini's regime, which celebrated its 40th anniversary last month, God and politics were inextricable. Politics was God, and God was politics. And oh, how I and most of my family detested that. When I was a boy, my birthday, February 1st, which, as I said, was exactly 6 years to the day that Khomeini returned and brought the new regime with him, was the subject of a long-running joke in our family. One of our relatives, an old police colonel who not only hated the new regime, but hated Islam himself, because he was your typical Iranian secularist, very much a product of the Shah's regime, detested Muhammad. Would always ask me at every family get-together, and we had this running joke together. And it ran something like this. He would say, "When were you born, Sohrab?" And I knew that he knew the answer, but I played along anyway, and I would say, "February 1st. And he would hold his nose and say, "Pif, pif, you brought the imam with you." Which meant that I brought the disagreeable scent of Khomeini. The punchline didn't need explaining. Everyone laughed, because the sentiment was so widely shared in our urbane, middle-class, you could say bohemian milieu. Having supported the revolution, my family had come to bitterly regret it. The collapse of 2,500 years of Persian monarchy didn't win popular rule for Iran's middle classes, and it made life much more miserable than it had been under the Shah, the last Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, King of Kings as he was titled. Yet rebel my parents and grandparents had for my maternal grandfather, it was nationalism that ignited his revolutionary spark. For my grandfather, his father had been elected to the Majlis, or parliament, that was founded right after Iran's 1905 constitutional revolution. It was this brief abortive period of constitutionalism in Iran, and it was suffocated for two reasons. One, because the great powers, mainly Britain and Russia, opposed it, but also because Iranians didn't have the habits of constitutionalism, and constitutionalism never took to Iranian soil. So my grandfather had come to see Iranian history as a long chain of grievances suffered at the hands of the outsiders. And although that those grievances, some of them were legitimate, because, for example, communist subversion hatched in Moscow was a real threat throughout his life, and it's certainly true that Britain and other Western powers as well just would violate Iran's sovereign territorial integrity when it suited their geopolitical ends. Over time, it had hardened into a kind of paranoid history of the world, let's say, in which Muslims or Iranians had originated all that was worthwhile in the world only to have their best inventions and ideas usurped by the West. So for him, again, the 1979 revolution was about restoring Iran's lost honor after millennia of humiliations at the hands of outsiders, going back to Alexander the Great's conquest of Achaemenid Persia. For my parents, on the other hand, 1979 held other promises. In fact, I could say that I'm the child of two revolutions. One was the revolution of 1979, but the other was the revolution of 1968, which I heard was alluded to in the previous talk. So the Pahlavi monarchs had forged a modern secular nation-state out of the shambolic remains of the old Persian Empire. Yet rapid development, a sudden kind of burst of middle-class jobs and middle-class lifestyles, had only left Iran's restive young boomers feeling more restive, and contact with the West only heightened their sense of inadequacy in the face of the West. So they read various hot-headed French philosophers and concluded that the answer to their dissatisfactions lay in making revolution erasing all hierarchies and traditional forms of authority and creating an entirely new order. So that meant that in our household, this is, by the way, post-revolutionary Iran, but in our household, it was a completely 68-ish world, where the only moral commandment that my father handed down to me was, be yourself. And I was discouraged from a very young age, and to this day I can't bring myself to do it, because that's the habit of not referring to my parents by their titles. I wouldn't say ma or pa, or mother and father, because those were redolent of authority and tradition. They actually urged me to call me, but call them by their first name, which I've never encountered anyone else, maybe some of you, but I've yet to encounter anyone in Iran or the West for whom that was the norm. That was the household I grew up in. But neither the old school nationalists like my grandfather, nor the secular minded leftists like my parents, had any clear idea of what they wanted after the fall. But not so with Khomeini's followers, mainly among the conservative merchants of the bazaar and the pious provincial multitudes. People who had suddenly found themselves, due to rapid industrialization or urbanization, migrating from the provinces to the big cities, Tehran and a few others, and they encountered under the Shah's regime a tolerated red light district that was called the Citadel, and other habits that were astonishingly offensive to them, and so they heard Khomeini's message, the message of restoring Islamic continuity, restoring order, moral order. And they had a very clear picture of what that meant. Immediately, Khomeini laid the foundations of a total state. This, despite the fact that in his radio tapes, tape-recorded messages that would be circulated around the country, he said repeatedly that dictatorship is the greatest sin against Islam. He outlawed political parties, purged the institutions, dismantled independent labor unions, summarily executed erstwhile secular and leftist allies. The hijab became mandatory for women. Dancing, drinking, and foreign movies and music, and most other forms of fun, were now strictly prescribed. The new Iran was a land of conspiracies and denunciations, while utopian fantasies and pervasive dysfunction were each day began and ended with the litany of the names of the newly executed enemies of the revolution, barked out on state radio by men with mad foghorn voices. So all this led me to conclude, or to declare myself an atheist at about age 12 or 13. I remember the circumstances vaguely. I was on holiday with my parents in northern Iran by the Caspian Sea. Most many middle class families from Tehran, the capital, have villas by the Caspian Sea where they go for the summer. But my family did not own a villa, but we had very many friends who did. And we spent most of the day on the beach. Only Sharia law now demanded strict separation of the sexes at sea. So at most public beaches, the regime would curtain off vast swaths of the sea to create separate men's and women's areas. Everywhere there were banners that read, "My sister, mind your veil. My brother, mind your eyes." But my parents and their friends usually found hidden corners where men and women could share the beach away from the watchful eyes of the Islamic Republic's morality committees, specifically a committee for the promotion of virtue and the discouragement or whatever of vice. At a previous talk, I got those backward, but I think that's right. They would even bring bottles of arak. You've probably heard of it among Turks, it's arak, which is Iran's searing homemade spirit, a kind of vodka. Often gets you blind, in defiance of official prohibition. If the morality police showed up in their signature Toyota 4x4s, though, it all wasn't lost. Most of the officers could be bribed to overlook such iniquities. The adults in the party would receive a stern scolding, they would make excuses, apologize and vow to never do it again, and the officers would say, "Well, if you're having such a good time, give us a taste of your candy." And what that meant was a signal for the men to reach for their wallets, pull their cash, and pay off the provincials. Now, there was always a non-zero chance that the officer in charge was an actual believer. Then a flogging could be in order. But it's not true, as many of you think, you know, if you get caught with alcohol in Iran, you get flogged. Yes, that's the law that's on the books. But in many cases, the agents of God can be quite pliable. So one night during that summer of 1997, in the borderland between childhood and pubescence, I began thinking seriously for the first time about all this, And I concluded that religion was little more than a ritual of public hypocrisy, and one that I'd be expected to perform, well, not if I could help it. I concluded right then that there is no God. It helped that I knew that my mother actually specifically was about soon to get a green card, so I could declare my atheism with a little bit more abandon than I would if I knew that I was stuck in the country. There was more to it than that, of course. Living in an Islamic theocracy, where God appears in the form of floggings and judicial amputations, scowling ayatollahs and secret police has a way of souring you on things divine. Years later, I read and edited a wise young Iranian dissident essayist who argued that if the Islamic Republic collapsed one day, which is looking shakier than ever, it would leave behind the world's largest community of atheists. And unfortunately, I think that's true. So my turn away from God had not a little to do with the nature of Islam, the Islam of Khomeini's followers at least, a religion that never proposes but only imposes, and that by the sword or the suicide bomber or the Kalashnikov-wielding fanatic. Across wide swaths of the Islamic world, the religion of Muhammad is synonymous with law and political dominion without love or mercy. As the French philosopher Pierre Manon has written, Islam, quote, is a starkly objective faith, and where it spreads, a set of authoritative norms and a political community follow. To assent to the law and to the community is to assent to Islam. There's little room for the individual conscience and free will, for reason and intellect in that assent. So there I was in a little villa on the Caspian, cursing God and professing my disbelief in him. I cursed the God who required a police state to enforce his whims, but whose agents were willing to cut corners for the right price. And I half expected my curses and blasphemous declarations that night to conjure up demons and jinn are Islamic kind of ghosts, who would drag me to the netherworld, never to be seen again. But my curses produced no immediately discernible effects. It would take me years, decades even, to notice that I had been dragged, or had dragged myself, into another world of a kind. No cartoonish demons inhabited, but there were demons, and it was another world all the same. Not long after that, I immigrated to the West with my mother, and the miseries that unbelief inflicted on me would eventually take me to a small chapel in central London, where I would be received into the Roman Catholic Church in December 2016, with detours through Nietzsche, Camus, Sartre, Marxism-Leninism, postmodernism, poststructuralism, Judith Butler, Michel Foucault, and a brief spell of evangelical Christianity. So it's the story I tell in my memoir, From Fire by Water. As you know, there are copies available. But the bottom line, though, is that I found in Roman Catholicism a God who not only wasn't unreasonable and capricious, but was reason itself, as Father himself said. Now, you might say, now that you've found God or a God, you want to impose him on the public square, which is why I said, does politics need God? And I answer in the affirmative. Well, that may be. Just leave that out there. But some gods are more reasonable than others. And after much thinking and life experience and reading, I've come to conclude that politics, as our common life together and public life proper, are actually impossible without God. A secondary point, which I won't develop here today, is that even the postmodern, atheistic, technocratic societies like ours in the U.S. and across much of the developed world do actually worship various gods and idols, but under other names. So this then brings me to Pope Benedict's Regensburg lecture, which is at the intersection of precisely these questions: modern secularism, Islam, and the reasonable God. I think it's one of the most, is one of the most misunderstood papal addresses in recent years, but it's also one of the most prophetic, and to my mind. Benedict XVI delivered that address in 2016 at the University of Regensburg, where he had once taught theology, back when he was just Father Ratzinger. As many of you will remember also, partly owing to an inexcusably bad translation by the Vatican, partly to the opportunism of various Islamist preachers and regimes, and partly to the religious illiteracy of many Western reporters, the address triggered an explosive response across the Muslim world. First the reporters, then the mullahs and the muftis, and finally the Arab street seized upon a single quotation to portray the entire address as a crude harangue against Muslims, when it was anything but. That quotation came from a famous dialogue between the Byzantine Christian Emperor Manuel II Palaiologos and a thoughtful, unnamed Persian Muslim interlocutor at the tail end of the 14th century. And I highly recommend, if you haven't read it, to read that dialogue. It's available for free online. It's very fragmentary. Much of it is really boring. But it addresses, it's one of those testaments to the fact that there's nothing new under the sun. So, for example, I happened to look into it because I was reading about Regensburg, and then this controversy came up where the New York Times ran a couple of stories recently, essentially suggesting that the abuse crisis is a product of priestly celibacy, and that the demands that priestly celibacy makes are just too inhuman. And the answer that the Byzantine emperor gives in these is magnificent, like Manuel gives. And I would urge you to look that up. And I won't get into it because it's a digression. But so discussing the relationship between religion and violence, Manuel tells the Persian, "Now show me just what Muhammad brought that was new, and there you will find things only evil and inhuman, such as his command to spread by the sword the faith he preached." What the Vatican's initial translation missed, of course, was Benedict's prefatory remark, namely that Manuel spoke, quote, and this is Benedict talking, "with a startling brusqueness, a brusqueness that we find utterly unacceptable." But that didn't come out until later. To note this, by the way, isn't to deny that the Regensburg lecture contained a critique of Islam. It did. But that critique was far more sophisticated than its thoughtless interpreters imagined. And on the whole, the polemical thrust of the address was turned against various trends in Western and even Christian thought. To wit, Benedict was taking issue with intellectual movements, including within Christian theology, that seek to exclude religion, Islam and Judaism as much as Christianity, from the realm of reason, treating faith as at best a purely subjective matter. So let me briefly trace his argument as a whole. I apologize to the 90% of you or 99% of you who have read the Regensburg address recently, but perhaps for my own benefit as I draw on my arguments, I'll summarize it, which I think makes clear why the Regensburg address is the briefest statement that makes clear that it's in accord with reason, indeed demanded by reason, that we include God in the public square. That is, provided we're talking about a reasonable God. Not the God of judicial amputation to the secret police, but also not the purely subjective God of various post-Christian forms of Christianity. Bear with me. In making his forceful case against spreading faith by the sword, Benedict says, Manuel really is claiming that, quote, "not to act in accordance with reason is contrary to God's nature." This is Benedict's summary of Manuel's claim. That claim, of course, runs against Islamic teaching, in which, quote, "God is absolutely transcendent, and therefore his will is not bound up with our categories, even that of rationality." Now, Benedict asks, is this conviction of Manuel's merely an imprint of the Byzantine emperor's Greek education, or is it inherently true of God, certainly of the God of the Bible? For Benedict, the answer is the latter. What we see in Manuel's discourse, he says, is, quote, "the profound harmony between what is Greek, in the best sense of the word, and the biblical understanding of faith in God." Allow me to quote Benedict at some length. Modifying the first verse of the book of Genesis, the first verse of the whole Bible, John began the prologue of his gospel with the words, "In the beginning was the Logos." This is the very word used by the emperor. God acts with logos. Logos means both reason and word, a reason which is creative and capable of self-communication precisely as reason. John thus spoke the final word on the biblical concept of God, and in this word, all the often toilsome and torturous path of threads of biblical faith find their culmination in synthesis. "In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos is God," says the evangelist. Or put another way, now this is me speaking, "In the beginning was reason, and reason was with God, and reason was God." Benedict goes on to show how this synthesis between the best of Greek philosophy and biblical faith didn't happen by chance, but rather was the product of providential action, beginning with Almighty God's various encounters with the Jewish people. But that debate need not detain us here. I urge you again to revisit the full address for the details. Now, the most charitable interpreters of Islam would insist that Muhammad's faith was also in accord with reason at one point, but that owing to essentially a philosophical debate in which Al-Ghazali and his various followers, who were anti-philosophical, they triumphed over the Islamic ratio, and therefore it lies dormant or obscured or somehow hiding in occultation for roughly 8 centuries. Now, I'm not a scholar of Islam. As you can tell, I was barely Muslim when I was a Muslim nominally in Iran, let alone now. What I do know is that growing up in the world's first modern Islamist state, I encountered precisely the cruel, capricious, unreasonable God that Manuel decries, and that I came to detest that God. You will know them by their fruits. The real crisis, the one that should worry us, is the long eclipse of Christian reason, particularly outside the Catholic Church. And this, not the internal debates in Islam, was Benedict's main concern as a pastor theologian, because it concerns the fate of the West. As Benedict said, quote, "This inner rapprochement between biblical faith and Greek philosophical inquiry was an event of decisive importance, not only from the standpoint of the history of religions, but also from that of world history. It is an event which concerns us even today. Given this convergence, it is not surprising that Christianity, despite its origins and significant developments in the East, finally took on its historically decisive character in Europe. We can also express this the other way around. This convergence, with the subsequent addition of the Roman heritage, created Europe and remains the foundation of what can rightly be called Europe. And I would add the very best of America to that as well. But so for several centuries now, Benedict warns, a long and ugly divorce has torn reason and Christianity asunder. The 265th Pope calls this divorce de-Hellenization. He identifies 3 stages in the process. First came the Protestant so-called Reformation, says Benedict. Looking at the tradition of scholastic theology, the Reformers thought they were confronted with a faith system totally conditioned by philosophy, that is to say, an articulation of the faith based on an alien system of thought. As a result, faith no longer appears as a living historical word. This phone is calling. As a result, faith no longer appeared as a living historical word, but one element of an overarching philosophical system. The principle of sola scriptura, on the other hand, sought faith in its pure primordial form, as originally found in the biblical word. Metaphysics appeared as a premise derived from another source, from which faith had to be liberated in order to become more fully itself. Now, Martin Luther's hatred of philosophy is well known and shaped Protestantism decisively. It's why I'd argue that with our Protestant brothers and sisters, when they come to having to argue things before the Supreme Court, they often turn to Catholics or people like Justice Gorsuch. Luther thought of philosophy, but not as an ally of faith. That is something that is embedded in the Gospels, but something extraneous, a web of heathen nonsense that reformers had to machete through in order to get to the real gospel. The early Protestant stage of de-Hellenization, Benedict says, led naturally to the second, the liberal theology and biblical scholarship that arose in the 19th century, concomitant with the materialist revolutions of Marx, Nietzsche, Darwin, and Freud. The message of the second stage, Benedict says, was, quote, to return simply to the man Jesus and to his simple message underneath the accretions of theology and indeed of Hellenization. This simple message was seen as the culmination of the religious development of humanity. This is how we get Jesus as a kind of harmless moral thinker like Confucius, or Jesus as a liberal rabbi, or Jesus as a kind of self-affirmation guru. The third stage, finally, is a kind of multiculturalism that says that the Greek imprint on Christianity is a kind of historically contingent imposition and it doesn't go to the heart of the faith. According to this view, Benedict says, the synthesis with Hellenism achieved in the early church was an initial inculturation which ought not to be binding on other cultures. It's very typical of the way our age thinks. Thanks to de-Hellenization, Christianity has been removed and removed itself from the realm of reason. It's a purely subjective faith, weak in the face of an aggressive secularism and scientism, but also weak in the face of that starkly objective, virile, energetic Islam that I describe in the first half of my talk. On the other hand, Western scientism and materialism reduce man to a status much lower than the one that all revealed religions, the classical philosophy and metaphysics, including Islamic metaphysics, granted him. As a result, man's origin and destiny, the questions raised by religion and ethics, have no place within the purview of collective reason. And on the other hand, religion gets relegated to a purely subjective, purely private sphere, And in which case the question is, why should it have any say in public matters? The result is a community that says that the only questions worth asking are those with scientific technical answers. A community that encounters an intelligible world through its universe, really, through its senses and through its instruments, but can't bring itself to ask, let alone answer, why the world is intelligible to our senses and our instruments. It's a community that says economic growth and technological advancements are the only ideals worthy of the name. It's a community that says that there's no objective morality. And the only limiting principles against even our basest passions are consent and contract. Therefore, if a female actress, or a male one, in a porn video is abused by 7 men at the same time, well, here's her contract, here's her signature, here's her payment. Our bodies, ourselves. It's a community that says that men can menstruate and have babies. It's a community of astonishing connectivity and instantaneous communication where people nevertheless feel profoundly lonely. It's a community that would permit me, a married father, to abandon my family at will and spend the rest of my days engaging in a shockingly wide range of conduct prescribed by most societies across most of history, with my bank account again imposing the only limit on my depravity. A community without a reasonable God, then, is finally an unreasonable one, as unreasonable as the land of scowling ayatollahs and judicial amputations. Thank you very much.
So we have some time for questions. Yes.
My question is, when most people think of the end of, or God in the public sphere in America, I think it kind of conjures up what you describe, something like Ayatollah Khomeini or the Taliban, or like the Puritans in America. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it says something that a show like Handmaid's Tale is mm-hmm. fairly popular mm-hmm. in the United States. So how do you kind of get the public culture to kind of rethink its separation from God in that sort of way?
First of all, I'm not the first to make this point, but we're living in various ways under a Handmaid's Tale scenario. But the handmaidens are, or whoever they are, because I'm not a fan of the book, but they're secularists. But that's a very good question. I would look to situations in which history gives us a guide where there can be a reasonable synthesis between the two realms, and I think the first way to persuade the public is to point out how miserable and unreasonable the current situation is, and that will then spark the political imagination to see what the future would be. Because obviously the syntheses of the past can't be resurrected, and any attempt to do so is a foolish enterprise. But at the very least, pointing to all the needs that a thoroughly secular public square leaves unanswered, weigh it leads to various kinds of tribalism along the lines of race and class and sex and so forth. The way, as I said, it makes us feel so lonely because there's no... why should I feel like you're my brother or my sister if we don't share a common paternity? Therefore, I will be vicious towards you as much as I want to be. All of that, I think, our task now is to just point out that the present is miserable without God. And then I think it's up to smarter people than me to formulate what the alternative might look like.
Maybe, Saurabh, could you repeat the question? Because some of the
people
back cannot always... That's all right. Yes.
Next one, I'll do that.
Bill Ring from Darien, Connecticut. And you can hear that the Thomistic Institute is drawing people from far and wide. So that's much applause to them. The title of the conference, Does Politics Need God, seems to contain an ambiguity. That is, does politics need God in the citizenry or in the government? And if it's a government of limited powers and a citizenry that is imbued with a strong sense of theism, can the limited government succeed? And are most instances of a failure of limited government really a failure of God and the citizenry, so that the government itself becomes the predominant religion?
Do I need to repeat that, or is he loud enough?
Do you have a view on whether God needs to be in the citizenry, in the government, or maybe both?
I would say both. I think that, in the society I came with, God is in the state. But because it's an unreasonable God, whether, again, that goes back to original Islam or whether it's a distortion of it, it's turned the citizenry, who might even have their natural longing for God, to turn against God. On the other hand, a limited government in which God only appears in a sort of deistic form, as a sort of grand watchmaker at most, and then everyone else has to, you know, Scientology is as valid as any other religion, that again goes back to this idea that God is not something about which we can reason, and it creates a citizenry that's confused, because they, you know, any religious opinion is as good as any other, and so all sorts of bad religious opinions can thrive. So I think it's the idea that you can just have a religious citizenry, but the state itself says that the questions about God are totally beyond the realm of public reason, will lead to our current confusions.
Yes, sir.
David Ennis, the King's College. The premise of the Benedict option, it seems to me, is that there's a kind of civilizational reductio ad absurdum that's going on, and you alluded to that, some of those developments, and that our place is, the Benedict option is withdrawing, as it were, into church life, cultivating that church life. So when the absurdum becomes unavoidably obvious, there's a church life there to receive a despairing culture. If I'm correct in that, what sort of vibrant church life would you picture as worthy of receiving the people fleeing the absurdum?
I mean, for the first, as a threshold matter, the question is, let me make sure I understand, if the Benedict option is a sort of escape plan, can I envision an alternative in which church life is much more vibrant and imbues the public sphere in a vibrant way? I don't know what you mean by vibrant per se, but I think, am I formulating your question correctly?
I believe it's premised on developing a healthy church apart from public engagement, so that when this modern experiment works its way out into absurdity,
something is left.
Yeah,
to
something
them.
Is there, and people turn to it.
Got it.
What is it?
No, I think that people of faith need to take to the political sphere. That you can't retreat into you can create your small communities and so forth. But the nature of the modern world is such that you need access to the state, and therefore a religious only option in which we develop our own schools and our own blah, 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 is fine, but that doesn't mean that we can also afford to retreat from the public square. Mm-hmm. So deep political engagement is part of it. It also means, I think, for the church to be attractive, it has to be a counter witness to the world, and that, I think, is I guess part of the Benedict option idea, that it can't try to mirror the way the secular world is and expect itself to be attractive.
Yeah. Hi, Jack, great talk. So if you consider, you know, there are two definitions, let's call it, of God, one reasonable Catholic God or one unreasonable, the one that's unjust and would argue for these kinds of killings and sort of things that you experienced in your childhood. And we also look at the public square as a coming together of sort of different ideas and different religions and different perspectives. Where do you sort of say that, like, everything else that falls between these two points belongs?
Well, just because there are many opinions about the right or the good or the truth doesn't mean that one of them isn't right and others are half right.
Yes, sir.
How do you see the end of the Islamic Republic?
So odd that it should be a question I feel like I've used to be so confidently answer. I think that the idea of a Velvet Revolution style, Czechoslovakia, Poland type scenario that many of my friends on the right dream about is completely foolish. It's never going to transpire, just for various reasons. One being that the world itself is in a welcome way, I think, moving away from that kind of liberal messianic kind of spread of universal liberalism. Another being that it's completely alien to a country that has a 2,500-year history of absolutism. But that doesn't mean that a non-liberal or even non-democratic order, it doesn't mean that such an order couldn't be decent for Iranians. And I think the most likely type of scenario that I see is someone in the security apparatus thinks that the current regime, for all sorts of reasons, provides an opportunity for him to seize power, as every other dynasty has come to power before. We have right now bread riots in Iran, essentially widespread. The people are so demoralized, and the situation is so miserable that you could see a dynastic change again, as has happened several times in Iranian history. So some ambitious would-be potentate could emerge, and on a platform, I would say, of a kind of common good nationalism, which is a lot more popular among Iranians than if you say liberal rights talk, and depose the current regime from within. Something like Sisi.
And you beat me to it.
Did you say Sisi? Okay, yes.
You don't see the monarchy coming back.
Could be, or he could install himself as the Pahlavis were just, he was just a Cossack officer, and then was granted the divine right of kings. So, why not this next guy?
So, Sourabh, can I pose a question to you? You're a journalist,
yeah.
Now an editor, and you're looking at politics really from the perspective, you are able to opine about it, but you're also in a certain way reporting it. And does journalism need God? I don't mean that, like, do journalists need to be more religious, but does a religious perspective need to be in journalism in order for it to do its job well, or
as long as it doesn't mean that the Post can run headlines like Bezos exposes Pecker. I'm kidding, but in all seriousness, no. I mean, yes, because if your sense of the world is only as limited as facts, meaning what your senses and your sources and various statistics tell you, then you have a very a narrow sense of the truth. The fullest truth about the human person is that he's a created being with moral choice and so on and so forth is often absent from journalism, because it's like the rest of a kind of technocratic society, only deals with what can be seen or measured by instruments. And these deeper truths about the human person, about the purpose of our common life and so forth, get lost. But I would say that journalism will shift in a different direction when the whole of society is reoriented towards something better than this deracinated kind of technocracy. The journalism itself can't make the shift.
Let's give our thanks to Sourabh.